As Illinois voters head to the polls, we're interviewing candidates for statewide office. Today, Cash Jackson, the Libertarian candidate for governor.
We just want to be left alone. We want government out of our lives. We don't mind some taxation, and whatever you take, just spend it responsibly. And I don't think that's too much to ask, and I believe the average citizen really aligns with a lot of that.
Plus, we're going to be talking all this week about where the candidates stand on important issues. Today, we start with health care. Stay tuned to make sure you've got the lowdown before you vote. And in this era of policing, the director of the University of Illinois' Police Training Institute has been thinking about the importance of transparency and empathy for officers.
What we need to make sure that our recruits know and police officers know is that everybody we arrest is not necessarily a bad person. All good people have bad times, and we need to be empathetic to that.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. People all over Illinois gathered in support of their local Jewish communities this weekend and to remember the 11 people murdered Saturday morning while they were worshiping at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh. The Anti-Defamation League says they believe this is the deadliest attack against the Jewish community in the history of the United States. Vigils were held across the country this weekend, including right here in Illinois in some of our largest cities and college towns, including Rockford, Chicago, Champaign, and Carbondale.
May the Lord help us to extinguish the outbreaks of hatred that develop in our societies.
We're going to continue to practice our faith. We're going to still continue to be who we are because we don't want to run away.
If when they are worshiping in their worship place, they should be without any afraid, without any kind of thinking it could be happen with them. They should be free mind in their worship place.
It's a coming together and recognizing that we have to be good to each other.
It was touching and comforting to see people that represent the entirety of Chicago coming to stand with the Jewish community.
I hear from my grandparents, I'd always ask them, how did things happen when they were children during the Holocaust? And they said that no one spoke up. I think today, the good news, people are speaking up. And we must respond, both here on our campus, in our city, and across the world. We have to respond to hate, because we can't always say it's someone else's hate, because it's going to end up being in our own backyard.
Thanks to WTVO in Rockford, WSIL in Carbondale, WBEZ Chicago, and WILL in Urbana for that audio. The gunman has been arrested and charged with multiple counts of hate crimes and murder. Federal prosecutors have said they may seek the death penalty. Stay tuned to this NPR station for the latest on that story. Election Day is November 6th. All this week, we're going to be airing our interviews with candidates for statewide office, comptroller, treasurer, attorney general, and governor. Last Thursday, we heard from our Democratic nominee for governor, J.B. Pritzker. Today would have been the day we aired an interview with the Republican nominee, our current governor, Bruce Rauner. Unfortunately, his office did not respond to repeated requests for an interview with him. So this morning, we will hear from the Libertarian Party's candidate next. Grayson Cash Jackson has served in the U.S. Navy for 20 years. The veteran is now a stay-at-home dad from Antioch and the Libertarian candidate for governor. Cash Jackson, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me on.
So you've said your top two issues are corruption and Illinois' two-party system. And I wonder if we could start with corruption, because we think we hear this pretty much from every candidate running for office.
We do.
That this is a really important thing. I wonder if you can name a few steps you would take within your first 6 months, if elected governor, to actually fight corruption?
Well, I use this humor, and it's kind of tongue-in-cheek, if you will, that, look, we don't have enough transparency as it pertains to government in Illinois. And it's no secret. I mean, of course, it is tossed around a lot. Corruption, corruption, corruption. But we never really see any true strong concerted efforts made towards addressing it. And something I believe that we could do is utilizing today's technology. I mean, smartphones are very capable today, that we should be live streaming out of our legislators' offices. I don't know if many people have watched committees and really watched how legislation unfolds and how they kind of do this juggling, if you will, of committee members to pass legislation. But it's really eye-opening and telling when you realize that, wow, it's like a big circus down here on how to get legislation passed. And I think that we should have live streaming capabilities in all of these committees and throughout our legislators' offices, and especially, I believe, through our judiciary. Many people don't realize that the judiciary has really exempted itself from a great deal of oversight and transparency. They're internally monitored. If there's any issues or complaints with judges, it's all internally handled. And I would really like to see that stuff come to the surface so that the public can see how they're all officials are operating. I believe that we should be releasing any emails that are exchanged. So through, let's just say, the governor's office.
You used to be a Republican. Traditionally, libertarians want to shrink the size of government in both our economic and social lives. I wonder if that's an accurate way of describing what your views now and what brought you to becoming a libertarian?
Yeah, that's pretty accurate. I wouldn't say that I was like a staunch Republican. I was just more conservative, like a lot of people. And the way that you vote, it would be more Republican. I have voted for Democrats and independents up in Washington State. And what really led me to the Libertarian Party was realizing that, number one, the Republicans, they're not very conservative. I mean, we see a lot of corporate welfare, defense spending through the roof. We're engaged in a lot of foreign wars. I believe that our foreign policy issues needs a lot of work. And that's kind of really what led me down the path to being a libertarian. I went to one meeting up in Washington State, a local chapter meeting, and right before I was restationed here in Illinois. And then once I got here, I got kind of involved and began learning a lot more about the platform. I'm like, wow, this is what we need. I think this is what really aligns with most people, that we just want to be left alone. We want government out of our lives. We don't mind some taxation, and whatever you take, just spend it responsibly. And I don't think that's too much to ask. And I believe the average citizen really aligns with a lot of that.
I want to ask you about taxes. So right now, if we just look at Illinois' state income tax rate, personal tax rate is 4.95% for everyone. Is that the right tax rate for all Illinois, to have everyone taxed at the same level?
I believe that it's the closest thing to being a fair taxation as opposed to a progressive tax. The only part that I would consider looking at and maybe changing for that is people living at and below the poverty line. My policy team and I have kind of went through some numbers and determined that we believe that we could waive income tax for people living below the poverty line, at and below the poverty line.
Waive state income tax.
Correct. And allow them the ability to, in effect, not pay any income tax. We want to help people living below the poverty line, because I've been there. I've lived at the poverty line and below as a teenager, and I know what it's like. I know what it looks like, and the struggles to get up out of poverty can be very, very difficult, and every little bit helps. People don't realize that even a few dollars can go a long way, because we know how to stretch a dollar. Poor people know how to stretch a dollar. I think that that's one method that we could use to begin to help them get up out of poverty, and I believe we can make that revenue up by the legalization of and taxation of recreational cannabis, as well as reducing our criminal justice system.
And when you say reducing our criminal justice system, what do you mean?
Well, I mean where we have so many people that are incarcerated for victimless crimes, i.e. the war on drugs. You're hard-pressed today to find people that would disagree that the war on drugs hasn't worked. It really hasn't. It's been a fundamental failure on the part of the United States, and I wish that it would have worked, but it hasn't. Look, drugs are a health issue. They're not a criminal issue. They're an economic issue. Oftentimes, what we find with people that are abusing drugs, especially our harder drugs, they're dealing with emotional and mental behavioral health disorders that have went undiagnosed and not dealt with. They're dealing with physical pain, and they abuse opiates because they've been prescribed that for so long. I know firsthand, because I have really good friends that are veterans, wounded in combat, and they don't use even medicinal cannabis because it's still Schedule I, and they're afraid of losing federal benefits because of that. Addressing the war on drugs as an economic and a health issue will significantly help to reduce criminal justice through the enforcement, adjudication, and incarceration cost.
I want to get to a couple other policy issues here. My guest is Cash Jackson, who's a Libertarian candidate for governor. Immigration is an important issue both here in Illinois and across the country. Do you think state resources should be used to help enforce federal immigration law when it comes to detention and deportation?
I'd like to see it dealt with on a local level. And I don't like federal overreach.
So by local, you mean state or you mean municipality?
Municipality. So, yeah, because I mean, I prefer to not have centralized government dictating all the way down on a local level how they're conducting business. Now, with that being said, let's take the city of Chicago. If Chicago decides, look, we're going to be sanctuary city, not something I would support as a governor. And that should not be a cost burden passed on to the rest of the state.
By support, you mean financially?
Financially, yes.
Okay.
So in dealing with any type of social welfare costs, anything to that effect, people are really opposed to lawful citizens in Illinois paying for undocumented and or illegal immigrants, whatever phrase you want to use. People are really opposed to they're paying into a system and another person isn't. Now, we must also clarify that the fact that these illegal immigrants do pay a significant amount into things like Social Security that they'll never collect. And so there is more to this conversation than what a lot of people want to have. And look, I'm not favoring illegal immigration at all, but let's put all the facts out on the table. Do they come here illegally? Yes. Do I support that? No, I do not. But let's also recognize they're paying the majority of the taxes that we're paying. They own homes, they rent property, they're paying property taxes. And in an unfunded education system with about 500,000, roughly speaking, illegal immigrants in this state, they're either renting or they're paying property taxes somewhere, which is going to help fund education costs that's already underfunded.
Can I ask you about public education? Because
yes.
Illinois has historically funded public schools in a very unequal way. That's changed for the first time this year. The state also relies very heavily on property taxes to fund schools. Is it time to stop funding public schools with local property taxes?
I don't know that it's time to stop, but I believe it's time to start transitioning away. And so I'm saying we don't need to come to an abrupt halt, if you will. But I believe that we should not be taxing people out of their homes. Look, if we take a look at education, we've got over 860 school districts in the state of Illinois, far more even than the state of Florida, which carries significantly more populace than what we do. I believe we could reduce the administration down from that many school districts to a more manageable number, 500-600. I don't know exactly what it would look like, but in doing so, consolidating that administrative overhead, we could then either A, save that money, or B, pass that money on to hiring more teachers and to funding better programs for our students and not paying six-figure salaries for superintendents and seven-figure pensions. I'm really opposed to that.
You were born in Louisiana. Why did you move to Illinois?
Well, the Navy. So spent 20 years in the Navy, retired up here. My younger two children reside in Lake County, and I wanted to be next to them and be able to raise them. So that's what brought me back.
And your children are also another reason why you've said you wanted to run for governor. And I wanted to ask you a couple of things about that. At the same time, I know that one of your ex-wives filed orders of protection against you over a couple-year period. But you've also said that Illinois' divorce laws kept you from your children and left you penniless. So I wanted to ask you first what you would say to voters who might have heard about this and might be concerned about this for someone who wants to be governor of our state.
Yeah, it's a legitimate concern, and it's something that needs to be addressed. Look, no matter which way you slice this, this system is broken. So my ex-wife did obtain orders of protection against me. These are commonly utilized as a tactic in family courts to gain an upper hand in custody proceedings. It in effect puts you, the person who's on the receiving end of one of these, in the position that you have to prove your fitness. And there's a very low standard of evidence required. It's only a preponderance, so it's a possible, it could have happened. Furthermore, you're not even present when they're obtained. So you're not even there to defend yourself. They're just given out. It's literally that easy. Now, where is this really broken? Let's presume for a moment that the allegations were true. Well, if she's making allegations of any type of violence or harm to her or my children,
which they were.
Right. So why would you leave somebody like that still on the street? Why wouldn't you incarcerate them? and adjudicate them appropriately? And if they, in fact, did do those things, why would you not incarcerate them? So you're not any safer as a community or a society by issuing something like this and leaving people like that still on the streets. But secondly, what if I'm not guilty? What if I didn't do any of the things that I'm accused of? If I accused you today of a criminal offense, let's just say I accuse you of abusing a child. With a very low standard of evidence, I could walk into one of these courts and say, with no proof, that you and I are in a relationship and I observed you abusing your child and gain an order of protection against you. This has even been done against parents that had where the accuser had no relation to the child and gained custody of the biological parent's child. It's a very broken system. They should only be done in criminal court. We need to elevate that standard of evidence.
So that's how you'd like to see it changed.
Yeah, I would like to see these only obtained in a criminal court, and then they should be adjudicated. If somebody like that is a legitimate risk to people, they need to be taken off the street, not left out on the street.
One of the jobs of the governor of Illinois is to be a cheerleader for Illinois. How would you sell Illinois to potential residents or businesses to relocate here?
Well, I mean, how can you not? Illinois is, number one, centrally located. It is a gorgeous state. I've been all over the state from the most southern tips to the most northern and to east to west. I've seen the entirety of the state, and it's a lovely state. Chicago is just a hub for tourism, and I think that we need to expand that, I believe, even more down south. Look, I'm an outdoors guy, a conservationist, and I love being outside in our state parks and forests that we have and our rivers and lakes. They are amazing, and I think we could do a much better job of attracting people here for the recreational activities that we possess, not to mention the fact that we're now we've legalized hemp. The hemp industry, I think, should explode in the next 10 to 20 years here, bringing back textile and manufacturing. There's a lot of reasons to move businesses here and to just visit.
Cash Jackson is a military veteran, 20 years. He served in the U.S. Navy. He's now a stay-at-home dad and the Libertarian candidate for governor. Thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Back to the 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. As you've been hearing, we are airing interviews with candidates for statewide offices. Stay tuned for the rest of the week as we speak to people who want to be our next comptroller, treasurer, and attorney general, as well as governor. But we also wanted to spend some time this week before Election Day digging a little deeper into where candidates stand on specific issues. And while hot button topics often come up during election season, when it comes down to it, how can state elected officials like governor or attorney general make a difference? We'll be doing all this week looking at issues like the economy and immigration, but today we're starting with healthcare. Joining us to help break all of this down are Dan Weissman, a Chicago-based public radio journalist, formerly of WBEZ and Marketplace. He's about to launch a podcast about the cost of healthcare called An Arm and a Leg. Matthew Weinstock, the managing editor of Modern Healthcare, is also on the line with us from Chicago. And in studio with me here in Urbana is Christine Herman, a reporter with Illinois Public Media and Side Effects Public Media. Hi, guys. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Nyla.
Hey, Nyla. Thanks for having us. It's great.
Matthew, let's start with you. Before we dig into specific healthcare issues, I just wanted to ask in general how often we're seeing healthcare come up as an election issue this year. Is it mostly around ACA?
Yeah, sure. That's a great question. And again, thanks for having me. It's not necessarily the argument. The debate has been a little more nuanced and moved a little bit away from the Affordable Care Act. We are still seeing healthcare as the top, or at least in the top three issues in most polling that goes on. The Kaiser Family Foundation, a nonprofit group that does research into healthcare, their most recent poll shows that healthcare for 30% of voters is their top issue, which leads the pack ahead of the economy and jobs. There are slight differences when you go into party affiliation. So for Democrats, it's about 40% of Democrats, 31% of independents say it's their top issue. And then among Republicans, it's at about 17%, trailing immigration and economy. So again, still in those top three issues. I think the difference that we're seeing this year versus 2016 is that the messaging, both in Illinois and nationally, is a little more nuanced. So Democrats are sort of painting Republicans, trying to tie them to moves the Trump administration has made to give states and insurers a little more freedom to offer plans to consumers that don't comply with the Affordable Care Act. For instance, allowing insurers to not cover pre-existing conditions, which they are required to do under the ACA. But the Trump administration has made some moves to make that a little less stringent for insurance companies. So Democrats are painting Republicans in that guise of taking away your coverage. On the flip side, Republicans are trying to paint Democrats in this corner of universal coverage, the government taking over health care, some notion of Medicare for all, which, while we haven't seen specific policy on it, is definitely a policy initiative that's been talked about among the progressive wing of the Democrats.
Right. So we're going to get into some of that. But let me, Dan, ask you, and when it comes to the Affordable Care Act, I think it's often not clear what states' roles are in this issue. So if we hear a candidate for governor talking about Obamacare, does this make a difference?
Thanks, Nyla. Yeah, I think it kind of does. There's a couple of things to mention about the governor's office and this governor. Bruce Rauner, over the summer, vetoed a bill that would have limited one of those kind of Trump administration initiatives that Matthew was just talking about. It would have created more, the Trump administration, as I understand it, wants to create more flexibility for what are called short-term plans, which don't have to offer, for instance, what the ACA calls essential benefits, which is really like everything. And so they have a lot of flexibility on the insurer's part. The price can be lower. So the legislature, you know, run by Democrats, passed a bill saying, no, we're gonna Illinois is going to sit out that flexibility. And Governor Rauner vetoed it. So that's an area where, you know, it's a kind of direct battle politically. The other thing is the governor appoints the state director of the Department of Insurance, which, you know, is tasked with, like, running the exchanges and making sure they run okay, and is also the kind of the group that you, as a consumer, can complain to about your insurance company.
Oh, right. So that's actually really, yeah, that's really important then, right, Dan?
Well,
we've actually got some audio, and I wanted to play. We have some audio of Governor Rauner. This is from WTTW. This is Governor Rauner talking about his health care plan at the Republican Governors Association meeting in Washington last year.
Trying to do something as important and big as this real fast could damage a lot of people's lives, and we've got to be cautious about this, and we need to be thoughtful. What's clearly broken is the insurance market on the exchanges. That's clearly broken. When you look at the costs and you look at the number of insurers who've abandoned the exchanges, we've got to focus on getting that fixed.
Okay, so not a lot of detail there. Governor Rauner at the Republican Governors Association last year, thanks to WTTW for that audio. And he also told the State Journal Register earlier this month, healthcare is where he's, quote, made his greatest strides as a governor. Dan, I'm going to ask you to comment on that in a second. But first, I want to just play what J.B. Pritzker told us when we spoke. This is actually not from our interview with him last week, but during the primaries when we spoke with him about what he would do for healthcare.
I've been on the front lines fighting against the Trump administration's attempt to repeal the Affordable Care Act. But the plan that I put forward, Illinois Cares, is a public option. You know, this is what President Obama proposed along with the Affordable Care Act, but wasn't able to include in the legislation because he couldn't get enough votes for it. We could do it here in the state of Illinois and should. It doesn't cost the taxpayers anything because people can buy into the system. And even if, God forbid, we lose the Affordable Care Act and they block grant Medicaid dollars to the state, we still could do the public option Illinois Cares.
That's a Democratic candidate for governor, J.B. Pritzker. So, Dan, as we heard two different pieces of audio there from the Republican and Democratic candidates, it sounds like, as we're thinking about that in the lens of what you said, it is important to think the governor does have some role, particularly in implementing exchanges and how those get run in a state.
Yeah, as just my own experience, as somebody who's been shopping for health insurance this year, I went on in September to look like, well, what's going to be available for 2019? And this has been a pattern, like nothing, no information was there. in September where other states, I was looking, like had posted the information about what plans there would be. Illinois has been lagging in that every year. And, you know, that information's up there now a few days before enrollment begins. But that's a...
Maybe a reflection of Governor Rauner saying he thinks it's a broken system, it sounds like.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know why the state is, this state decided to hold that information back from consumers, but it's a state decision and it's the Department of Insurance's decision.
That's Dan Weissman. We're speaking to him. He's actually about to launch a new podcast about healthcare called An Arm and a Leg. Matthew Weinstock is on the line with us from Chicago, where he's managing editor of Modern Healthcare. And Christine Herman is here with me. Christine is in studio with me and here in Urbana. She's a reporter for Side Effects Public Media, among a couple of positions she holds for WILL. Christine, I wanted to ask you about something else, because we hear pre-existing conditions, and I think we've been focusing on state officials, but I want to just take a step back from that for a moment, because this morning the Washington Post is actually calling out Republican politicians for twisting one of their fact check articles about pre-existing conditions. And two of the seven lawmakers are actually in Illinois, the 6th District's Peter Roskam and the 13th District's Rodney Davis. And in fact, what the Washington Post was calling out this morning was what Davis said during a debate that we had for WILL that I moderated between Davis and Democratic candidate Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan. Let's just play a little bit of what the congressman said during that debate.
Don't believe the lies that I'm trying to take away pre-existing condition coverage. That is not the case. I have voted to repeal and replace Obamacare with the American Health Care Act. And the lies about pre-existing condition coverage being taken away have been scored a 4 Pinocchio by the Washington Post. Read the bill. In the bill, it specifically says, nothing in this bill shall allow insurance companies to deny anyone coverage for pre-existing conditions.
That's Congressman Rodney Davis in Urbana a couple weeks ago at a debate that WILL had that I moderated. I should note, for those of you who haven't heard the whole debate, he was actually followed up and fact-checked in that moment about what he said. But Christine, this was part of something the Washington Post also called out today, because they are saying, no, we did not say this.
Right. So the Washington Post fact-checked article, I did look it up to see what was he referring to for Pinocchio's. It was actually a fact check regarding a statement about how many people have pre-existing conditions, not whether the American Health Care Act would continue to offer protections for them. So the Washington Post points out in an article today that fact check was published before the Congressional Budget Office report came out that concluded that the American Health Care Act could result in spiraling costs for people with pre-existing conditions. So what Davis pointed out there at the end of his quote, that nothing in the bill would allow companies to deny coverage for conditions. Actually, the words in the bill are insurance companies shall not limit access. So what Davis failed to point out is that one of the most recent GOP bills to overhaul the Obamacare would have given states the ability to let insurers charge more for people with pre-existing conditions. So the Washington Post article points out, you know, everyone has access to buying a Tesla, but it makes a difference whether you can afford to actually buy it.
And so that's the whole argument with these pre-existing conditions, what it comes down to. If it coverage is offered, but it might be so expensive that it's out of reach for a lot of people.
There are certain waivers that states could buy and could implement to allow insurers to make that coverage more expensive and possibly put it out of reach for many people.
Something I just wanted to point out to our audience, and I know our folks who are listening in the Bloomington-Normal area, there's a debate there this evening between Davis and Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan. Let's go back to the state. Let's come back to state officials and state races. Dan, I wanted to ask you about the race for state attorney general and what role attorney generals can play, because I'm thinking about in other states like in Texas and Wisconsin and Florida, they've actually sued to end the Affordable Care Act. Do we know about Republican Erica Harold and Democrat Kwame Raoul's views on this?
That is a super good question. I actually don't know Erica Harold. I haven't seen her say she would join that lawsuit. Kwame Raoul pledges to support another lawsuit that's suing the Trump administration to block what he calls Trump's attempted sabotage of the ACA. So certainly, you know, state attorney general can play a role. They don't play it by themselves. Like if Illinois didn't have an attorney general, there would be these AGs in other states that would be doing that kind of stuff. One thing that is interesting to me is that the current attorney general has a healthcare bureau, which is very consistent with Lisa Madigan's kind of image that she presents as fighting for consumers. And that's kind of the basis on which she puts that forward. If you go to her website, it says like fighting for consumers, and this healthcare bureau is like a consumer watchdog. And as far as I know, that's not in the Constitution. The AG does not have to have a whole bureau set aside to do that. It'll be interesting to know what either candidate will do to maintain that.
That's a good question. Matthew, I wonder if I can turn to Medicare and Medicaid. And I know this gets confusing for folks, but it's just a reminder that Medicare is a federal program that's talking about mostly people over the age of 65, some younger people with disabilities. Medicaid is a program that gets funds from the federal government and in the state. So, Matthew, is that the role? So what role I wonder if you can just, before we get into different positions, what role Illinois plays, for example, in Medicaid, the governor? There is a lot of interaction there, right?
There is, absolutely. So, as you said, Medicare is principally for seniors and is run by the federal government. So your policies are going to come from Congress and then also the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Importantly, worth noting that Peter Roskam here in suburban Chicago is the chair of a very powerful committee in the House Ways and Means Subcommittee on Health. So he controls, as chair of that committee, the purse strings that go to Medicare. So he's obviously in a very contested race here in suburban Chicago. So what happens to him and the Republicans in the House will have an impact on Medicare. Medicaid is a split program between the federal government and the states. The states principally take the lead in the program, getting some funds from the federal government. In Illinois, I believe Illinois pays about 40% of the about $19 billion that it covers. Under Pat Quinn, Illinois did expand Medicaid coverage as part of the Affordable Care Act to people who historically had not had that coverage. So I think there are about 670,000 people in Illinois who now have health care coverage under Medicaid that heretofore they didn't have prior to the Affordable Care Act. What Governor Rauner, what you're seeing in some of the debate, certainly with Governor Rauner and other Republicans nationwide, is how do you sustain the costs of expanded Medicaid coverage? And obviously in a state like Illinois, where budget is a crisis, Medicaid and how we pay for that expansion continually comes up. J.B. Pritzker has pushed for even further Medicaid expansion. So that will come back to the State House and see how they can, if J.B. Pritzker were to win, how can they expand coverage and sustain those costs. One other thing worth noting, I think, in Medicaid is several red states have pushed for waivers from the federal government to start to impose work requirements or other restrictions on who is eligible for Medicaid. So, for instance, Indiana, Wisconsin have applied for these waivers. Indiana had it granted, where they would require beneficiaries to show that they're either in job training or working a certain number of hours a month to sustain their benefits. Governor Rauner has yet to push such a program. It would require legislative approval, but, you know, it is one way to help control the cost of the program.
Right. So that's helpful to know in terms of Medicare, the role that the governor can play in that. I think we just have time for one last topic. And Christine, I wanted to ask you, certainly something that we hear from all candidates, whether they're running for local office, state office, or national, is saying how much they want to handle the opioid epidemic, the crisis. Also, when we think about how that relates to mental health in particular, where do the governor candidates stand on these issues?
So Rauner recently signed a number of bills that should enhance coverage for mental health and addiction treatment, including a measure that would help require insurance companies to cover mental health and addiction on par with other medical issues, and that would be for both public and private insurers. Democrats and Pritzker have criticized Rauner, you know, for his handling of the budget impasse that led to many social service agencies, you know, reducing services, even closing down, for vetoing other legislation that would have helped combat the opioid crisis and proposing cuts to funding for addiction treatment. So what Pritzker has said is that he'll focus on youth mental health and early treatment, addiction prevention, and also work with the criminal justice system to get people arrested for drug-related crimes and into treatment instead of prison.
Thanks for that. That's Christine Herman. Christine has done a lot of reporting on this, so folks who are interested in this, as well as marijuana, one issue we didn't get to, we'll tweet out links to Christine's reporting on that. I want to thank Matthew Weinstock with us, a managing editor of Modern Healthcare. Dan Weissman, check out Arm and a Leg. It'll be out soon. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Nyla.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Earlier this month in Chicago, former police officer Jason Van Dyke was found guilty of second-degree murder in the case of 16-year-old Laquan McDonald. He was also convicted on 16 counts of aggravated battery with a firearm. The case is one of many across the country in which a police officer has fatally shot an African-American. It has called to attention yet again to how we hold police accountable. It's also brought into question how police officers are trained when it comes to community relations and being under the public microscope. That's an important topic for Michael Schlosser, who's the director of the Police Training Institute at the University of Illinois, something he does on a daily basis with the recruits he works with. He's in studio with me now in our studio in Urbana. Hi, Michael. Welcome back to The 21st.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, Michael, I mentioned Jason Van Dyke and Laquan McDonald. I think here in Illinois and in Chicago, certainly, people are figuring out what comes next from this. And I think first, there's a lot of media attention that comes with these cases, rightly so, because I feel like no one wants to see injustices or wrongful death. I think everyone can agree on that, right?
Yes, and I think it should be known that even police officers, when they see officers doing things wrong, in fact, especially committing crimes, that good police officers don't want the bad police officers out there, so they are happy to see, you know, when there's consequences for, you know, inappropriate behavior by police officers. We know that the majority of police officers are doing the jobs for the right reason, and they want to help people that can't help themselves, protect people that can't protect themselves. And this just kind of puts a black eye on it. And so many people have a tendency to, you know, see something like that and say, oh, all police officers are like that, or most police officers are like that, when that's truly not the case.
Do you think it's, in some ways it's difficult when you have organizations like the Fraternal Order of Police and the statements they made afterwards as well, though, that I think sometimes can be tough for people to handle?
Yeah, I think there's, you know, there's obviously organizations that are there to protect police officers and protect police officers' rights, but we still need to have justice. We still need due process. And we still need to eliminate officers that don't belong, but it really all starts from the hiring process and then the training process at an academy and then the continued training process within the department. And a lot of times that depends on the culture of a particular department they're going to.
And you were even saying, we were talking about this before we went on air, sometimes it's not even just the culture of a department. Sometimes it's even the culture of different shifts have different cultures.
Sure, sure. So there are different cultures, you know, within police departments. But a lot of times people don't realize that sometimes the culture is a little different maybe from, you know, the department, but also the shift. There's shifts that may have a little different way of doing things or a little different attitude than others, as well as different departments around the United States.
So I think when you're talking about training, that's what you do. One of the words that comes up a lot when we talk about police interactions with the community is empathy. And I wonder how important you would say having empathy is to your profession.
I think that probably the two things that are emphasized most at the police academy, besides our scenario-based training and practicing our de-escalation training and things like that, are treating everyone with empathy and respect. And I think what we need to make sure that our recruits know and police officers know is that everybody we arrest is not necessarily a bad person. All good people have bad times. They have financial problems. They have relationship problems. They have substance abuse problems. And we need to be empathetic to that and understand that. Plus, they're not really, when we arrive at the scene, no matter what they're saying to us, no matter how angry, no matter what cuss words they're using at us, they're really not mad at us. You know, they're mad at the situation. They're mad at what happened before we got there. So if we can keep in mind, you know, they're not angry at us, I can still understand, you know, their situation and have empathy and respect for them and treat them with empathy and respect, I have a lot better chance of gaining cooperation, compliance, and collaboration.
And so you and I have talked a lot about the de-escalation tactics that you work with officers on. And I think that's essentially what a lot of this comes down to, because I do think it's hard to think about cultivating empathy when you're in these situations on a daily basis where oftentimes you are seeing people maybe at their worst or in terrible situations.
You know, it's possible that maybe because of certain situations for police officers, maybe they don't really have empathy or respect for somebody. You know, maybe you just arrested somebody that committed an awful crime to a child or something like that. But we still have to remain professional, and we still have to show empathy, and we still have to show respect. So we call this tactical respect and tactical empathy. So you will always treat people with respect and empathy, even if it's not within you. It's just it's a strategy. It's a tactic. And if you can think of it as a tactic more than actually even having to have empathy and respect, then you're more likely to gain compliance and cooperation.
I'm speaking with Michael Schlosser, who's the director of the Police Training Institute at the U of I. And Michael, you do this with recruits, right? I mean, in terms of role playing, you have conversations. So how would this work in terms of cultivating this professionalism, this empathy? Is it really literally like a script sometimes that you have people remember?
Yes. So how we do that is we train not only the recruits, but we also train all of our role players. And we have over 128 employees, and many of them are role players, of course. And we put them through scripted scenarios, and they're constantly practicing using their de-escalation techniques. They're going to go into some violent domestic, some disturbances, some very high-end calls, and they have the ability to actually train and practice using these techniques, and they learn by doing them. They learn by watching other recruits going through. They learn through the facilitating of a discussion within the scenarios, but we have more scenario-based training like that throughout the entire 14 weeks than probably any other academy in the state.
So when we think about the whole idea of skepticism of the police, obviously in Chicago, this has been a big issue in the aftermath, not just of Laquan McDonald's death, but frankly for some time. This isn't necessarily an issue everywhere, but I wonder what you think about that skepticism. Do you think it's okay for people to be skeptical of police?
Oh, absolutely. And I'm skeptical of certain police departments, but not necessarily the whole department. I know a lot of Chicago police officers that are really good officers, so we can't just say this is all of every Chicago police.
This is a CPD problem.
Yeah, this is a CPD problem, because there's a lot of good officers there. But I think it's important to be skeptical. I think it's important for, you know, people like Craig Futterman, who brought the video, you know, he was able to obtain that of Laquan McDonald and things like that. The concern that I have with any time that there's something in the news where an officer has done something wrong, or even a use of force case that involved deadly force where the officer was justified, that because this is getting so much attention, police officers are sometimes less likely to use as much force as they should. And we call this either the Ferguson effect or the YouTube effect. And officers have at times not used force when they should have, or not used enough force when they should have, because they're afraid. They're like, I don't want to be the next one on the news. I don't want to be the next one on CNN or YouTube. So, you know, we still want them to go out and do their jobs properly. And the most important part of that is proper continuous training and confidence on that.
And so you would, I know that's what you always say, the way that this can be solved is by more training. Does that happen? So cadets are with you for 14 weeks. What about continuous training? I mean, I think what you have been doing over the past couple of years at the Institute here may be different than the way things were done years ago and for men and women who have been on the force for a long time.
Yeah, so a lot of what we've been doing for a long time, the police agencies are doing more of it, and our Illinois Law Enforcement Training and Standards Board is requiring more training and mandatory training on things like mental health issues and de-escalation training. So I think people are catching on that this is important, and we are increasing it everywhere. But we do need – it can't stop at the academy. It has to continue with in-service training once they get back to their departments.
And when we're thinking about topics like empathy, I think one of the things that comes up also is, as you're talking about mental health, I wonder how much if you think there needs to be a cultural, certainly within society, we're not good at acknowledging mental health issues or people taking care of themselves and proper emotional care of themselves. Do we think police officers are more sensitive to that now among themselves?
Absolutely. And this has been a lot of additions that things that we've been already doing, but a lot of additions that the state is now requiring. We can get better training on crisis intervention. We can understand trauma-informed policing, understanding people and, you know, how to respond, but also understanding the trauma that people have gone through. And this may have resulted in the behavior that we're arriving to. You know, there's a crisis situation, but we can't think it's just, okay, this is a crisis that just occurred. We have to understand, you know, try to be empathetic and understand other people's life experiences and what this has come to.
And that's what you mean by trauma-informed.
Yes, trauma-informed understanding.
Is that something that you teach? Is that something that also you're mentioning new state laws around this? Is this something that forces across the state are learning more about?
Yes, it's all across the state. We are also teaching that.
The Police Training Institute, other police academies, they're responsible for doing that.
Yes, there are new mandates since we went from a 12-week academy to a 14-week academy where there's a lot of these types of things that are mandatory now. And I think it's also important to mention that it is now mandatory, something that we've been teaching for years, for police officers to also have classes on their own wellness and stress management and things like that, so that, you know, they don't have that stigma and the fear of, you know, I'm having some problems. These are some things that I've seen. This is the vicarious trauma that I have through all the different things I've seen and heard, and it's okay to seek out help. And I tell recruits it takes more courage to speak up and say, I'm having some problems and I need to talk to somebody.
Do you think that police are being held to different standards than they were even different than 5 or 10 years ago?
I think that good police officers should have, in my opinion, and have always been held to a higher standard. And I think that with the new things that are out with the media and all of the things we're discussing today, you know, we're thinking, okay, they need to be held to a higher standard. They always should have been held to a higher standard, but because there's more attention given to it, then I think that even helps more to reach that higher standard for, you know, what we're looking for in a police officer.
Michael, I think no matter how many conversations you and I have on the radio about this or how many videos we watch or interactions people see, most of us will never be in the shoes of a police officer and know what that's like. So what do you want people to know or think about that?
I think some things to know are police officers are regular people. We have families, you know, they go to church, they do things with their kids. They're just regular people and they're caring and they're compassionate. They care about people, but the job is a very difficult job and you do get a lot of scrutiny, but you're also doing a dangerous job and it's a very honorable and noble career. I would also like people to know that even though based on the things that are important to cover by the media and the television shows that make good television for cops, they need to realize that the fact is that 90% of all arrests made, there's no force used. And it's the odds of a police officer ever having to fire their weapon in the line of duty is less than 0.03% in their entire career. In fact, I just read a study recently where 95% of all NYPD officers who have retired, 95% never fired their weapon in the line of duty. So it's a lot less than people probably think.
I wonder if also we have to change our thinking there are good people or bad people in the world and maybe just think about the fact that there are just people who sometimes do good or bad things.
Yes, it's like I said before, there are people that do bad things that you might consider bad people. But the majority of people that we arrest are good people in bad times with bad life experiences and they have problems. And I think that's important to remember that, you know, we can have that better understanding and empathy toward people. A really important thing that I try to get across to recruits is a very simple part of community policing. And that is where police officers need to have what we call more non-enforcement contacts. Not when it's a domestic, not when it's a traffic stop. We get out of our car. We get to know people as people. They get to know us as a person on a more personal level. And then we can gain the trust of citizens, and we need to gain the trust of all citizens. That's a great way to get out and realize, hey, you're a person, I'm a person. We get to know things about each other. It makes things safer for the public, and it makes things safer for the police.
That's Michael Schlosser, who's director of the Police Training Institute at the University of Illinois. Michael, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Anytime.
That's all the time we have for today. If you follow us on Twitter, our handle's 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. You can also search for our Facebook page to like us. All those links, every other way to contact us. If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us at social media, just go to our website, 21stShow.org. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. See you back here tomorrow.